For the last 2.5 years, we've been wandering around the country talking about the women's movement. In the beginning, to very small groups of people, and we felt much more comfortable doing that because it was like a rap group and, you know, we could sit around and exchange views. Now we find ourselves talking to big groups like this one and standing up and lecturing in what is really very old style, which we don't like, and we're sorry. But we hope that in the question session afterward, you will feel free to ask anything or to say anything to each other as well as to us, because no group this size should be allowed to get away without becoming an organizing meeting. And if we come today and there's no trouble tomorrow, we haven't done our job. I know that there are very many, many brave women on this campus and in this community who have been active for a long time. I'm sure that nobody here thinks anymore that a bra ever got burned, although there was a group of women who threatened to burn one at a Miss America meatpacking contest in 1968. They also threatened to burn a dust mop and a steno pad and an apron and, I don't know, a lot of symbols of oppression, but they didn't do it because they couldn't get a fire permit. Nonetheless, we keep reading about bra burners, which is symbolic to me of the way in which this movement has been ridiculed and trivialized by the press, which is, in fact, the reason that we started to do this very inefficient and old-think thing of, you know, coming out to speak, and why we learned what, as women, we had not learned before, which is that it's possible to get up in front of a group and speak out. It's a woman's problem not to want to do it, right? So all I can say to everybody here, all the women here, is that if we are doing it, you can do it, and that you never stop being nervous. All you learn is you don't die. what we want to do is not to come to you as leaders of anything, because we are not. The women's movement is not into hierarchy, which is, in any case, an imitation of patriarchy. We come to you as individual women who want very much to say to you what we wish someone had said to us much sooner. I think what we would like to do most, and especially because the press has so trivialized what's happening to women, is to remind you and to remind ourselves that what we're talking about is a revolution and not a reform. It's a change that is perhaps the deepest and longest of all social changes. It has to do with the most fundamental ways we are organized into cheap labor in this society and in others, and that is by the fact that we look different. Whether that difference is racial or sexual, it is still used to isolate large numbers of the population and to use them as cheap labor. What's helped me the most to sort of understand that didn't have to be this way, and to counter all those arguments we all get about, well, if you're equal, why aren't you equal? If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Is the essential kind of argument you get. Is reading history, by which I don't mean what we learn in school, which is usually white male history, as we all know by now. We need remedial history to put it all back together again into human history. We need women's studies. We need black studies, Chicana studies. We desperately need all of those courses in order someday to put it back together into human history. But I'm talking about what we don't study, usually, or if we do, we do it through eyes glazed by present values, which is prehistory. I mean, the first 5,000 years, really, when the human animal was on this earth, recordably on this earth anyway, say from 12,000 to 8,000 BC, more or less. Because it turns out, although it's still very much debated, by anthropologists and other scholars, especially male scholars, that there's quite a lot of evidence that the first half of human history was a gynocracy. That is, women were superior, women were worshipped as the gods, women were the first-class citizens. Now, the reason that was true was because women had the children. That was regarded as a very enviable, mysterious, magical act. We've somehow allowed ourselves to get conned into believing that having children is an inferior function and makes us inferior. But for the first half of history, it was considered superior, and men's religious ceremonies, for instance, often imitated the act of childbirth because it was so envied. I guess it was a time of womb envy instead of penis envy, which seems every bit as sensible to me. But part of the reason this was true was because the process was indeed mysterious and paternity hadn't been discovered yet. A day I like to imagine is a big light bulb over somebody's head, right? And they're saying, oh, that's why. It was thought that women bore fruit like trees when they were ripe. And the cause and effect hadn't been examined or discovered. There's some indication that women discovered paternity many hundreds of years before they told men about it. Because they didn't want to give up their independence. But the discovery of paternity was a very cataclysmic event for civilization, and as cataclysmic at least as the discovery of how to make fire or how to shatter the atom. And that discovery began very gradually to fundamentally change the social structures. The idea of the ownership of children, for instance, evolved for the first time. Different kinds of structures to raise them in, because prior to that they'd probably been communal structures. The idea of private property, of passing property down to children. The origin of marriage, which was really locking women up long enough to make sure who the father was. All of these forms began gradually and very deeply to change. And women became, in a very fundamental sense, the first means of production. It became clear that women needed to be controlled, women's bodies had to be controlled, because we produced the workers and we produced the soldiers. And with this system of the primitive systems of marriage, which meant that women were locked up for periods of time in order to make sure of paternity, and with occasionally being incapacitated because of pregnancies, and most of all with our physical difference, our visible difference, whether or not we had children, we became the first second-class group, the first politically subjugated group. We were marked by our physical difference. We were locked up for periods of time. We were gradually more and more controlled by the state or early versions of the state. And we became, in a very real sense, the first political subjugation and the one which all other political subjugations were to follow. For instance, when groups that look different or talk different very often were marked by racial differences were captured and brought into this tribal society, they too were given the role of women. That is, they were also restricted by physical difference, marked very visibly, very easily, restricted in their movements, given the work to do that no one else wanted to do, the repetitive or boring or difficult work, which, as we know, is the definition of a feminine task. I mean, anything that a man doesn't want to do becomes a feminine task. In some societies, it's digging ditches, and in other societies, it's doing all the typing, and in some marriages, it's driving to the station and paying all the bills. In others, it's keeping very far away from both the car and the checkbook. But it's still anything a man doesn't want to do, and the technical definition of women's work is shit work. There became, therefore, a very close, not a totally identical, but a very closely paralleled kind of political subjugation to which women were subjected and to which all men racially marked in any society were also subjected. We see the parallel very clearly in this country because when black people were brought to these shores as slaves and no one knew what legal status to give them, it was natural to give them the same legal status as wives, which was chattel. And there has been this kind of parallel, and in periods of great social change in this country, the abolitionist movement and others, it has been a coalition, a loose coalition of the outs, which has made that change happen. Gunnar Myrdal, whom I hope that you discovered this little chapter in An American Dilemma long before I did. I wish I'd read it much sooner, because he is saying that the parallel between women, all women of all racial groups, and black or brown men in this society is the deepest truth of American life. We are the cheap labor on which the system runs. We are marked for it by our skins. Now, he is not saying, and I am not saying, and I think no one would say that the suffering is exactly the same, because women, white women, lose our identities, and black people, often women as well as men, risk losing their lives. Women die inside, and minority groups risk dying. But the myths are the same, and very parallel. So that now that we've just begun to realize how deeply racist this society is, when we hear ourselves making a generalized statement about women, if we substitute the name of any other racial group in the country, we begin to see what it is that we're really saying. Myrdal talked a lot about parallel myths, and he enumerated a lot of them, that women, all women, black and brown, all women, and black or brown men, are supposed to have smaller brains, passive natures, childlike natures, to have special job skills, miraculously always the poorly paid ones, to fill our cheap labor function. I mean, women are supposed to be great at detail work, right? But if it's poorly paid factory work, but if it's brain surgery, or you know, we're suddenly not so good at it anymore. And black people have great rhythm as long as they're sidemen in white musicians' groups. But not to own the record companies, right? Not to profit from their own productivity. The myths of employment and what we can and can't do are very clear. Then we're also supposed to be late all the time, and to be irresponsible, and to be unable to get along with each other. You know, we don't really want to work for or with each other. We can maybe govern our own affairs, but we can certainly not govern the affairs of white males. I mean, women can maybe rule the secretarial pool, and black people can maybe be their own representatives out of ghettoized areas, but they certainly can't make decisions about the real, you know, the adult areas of life which belong to white men. We are, we have more sexual natures, than more identified with sex than white men are. We have natural rhythm, I guess. According to television, we have peculiar odors, even. And there's a whole industry devoted to both making us feel insecure about the fact that we have natural odors and supplying highly expensive products to make us feel secure again. I don't know how anybody who's ever passed a locker room can really believe that one, but so we begin to see what it is we're really saying, in fact, when we make generalized statements about women. There have been some very interesting surveys lately that prove what all the women here know anyway, but it's always nice to have the male scientific stamp of approval, I suppose, except we should stop using it. By next year, we should stop using male references altogether. But the World Health Organization did a survey of cultures all over the world, not just this one, and could find no intellectual or emotional differences between males and females as groups. What was more interesting was that they could find no physical strength differences that could not be described as marginal or transitory. Transitory because they tend to exist only during the childbearing years. That is, young males and females and old males and females have about the same degree of physical strength. and marginal because even during the childbearing years, it is not that important. So it becomes clear that just how much of our feelings about what is masculine, what is feminine, are cultural, in fact, and vary terribly from one culture to the next. And it becomes very clear that we cannot make any accurate judgments based on the group of birth. The differences of the genital or hormonal differences between males and females, the skin pigmentation, feature, hair differences between racial groups are very, very much less great than the probable differences between two individual members of the same group, between two females, between two black people, between two white people. So it's the individual differences that count, and it's the individual differences that are being suppressed by this inhuman kind of categorization. We were talking earlier about Florence Kennedy, whom we lecture with as well. She's a lawyer from New York. She's been active for many years in the black movement, the women's movement, and all combinations thereof. And she puts it much more simply. She just says, listen, honey, you know, there are only a few jobs in the country that actually require penises or vaginas, and all other jobs should be open to everybody. Now, what we begin to see then, as these scales fall from our eyes, is that the position that women are in this society, and the position that racial minorities are in this society, is not natural at all. It is merely political. It did not come down to us from the sky, from God, wherever she is. Although I'm not sure whether I say that sometimes, but I'm not sure we should take over the concept of God in which such enormous harm has, in which name such enormous harm has been done. But it's interesting that God always looks exactly like the ruling class, don't you think? It's very suspicious. And it's interesting, too, that the church has been the champion myth-maker of all time, both racially and sexually. I hope that in the beginning of most of the great religions there was some idea of the essence of God in each of us, but it got lost pretty fast when the hierarchies set in, and you will find now in any great religion, whether it's Hinduism or Catholicism, that as the position of the priesthood goes up, the position of women goes down. The priesthood has always been jealous, as one Indian anthropologist put it, of the spiritual fulfillment which men achieve upon the breasts of women. Also, they only care about who's running the state. It doesn't matter whether it's the Bourbons and the priests, or whether it's the Pope, or it's Billy Graham and Nixon. They care very much more about, you know, who's running the place. I'm happy to say it's reversing itself now, though, because the position of the priesthood is going down and the position of women is going up, and it's about time. And Protestant women are voting in the church, which is some kind of revolution, I understand, mild as it sounds. And nuns are taking over from priests and saying, wait a minute, there's no reason why a woman should be a nun and a man should be a priest, or a woman should be a nurse and a man should be a doctor, and so on. And Jewish women are rewriting prayers, especially the ones that Orthodox Jews say every morning, Orthodox men, male Jews say every morning, thanking God that they were not born slaves and not born female. But we are beginning, just dimly beginning to see that the position of in this country and others of people who are racially or sexually marked as second class is entirely political. Now, once we realize some of this, which I guess you could call the feminist realization, a couple of things happen. One is you can't understand why we can't figure out why we couldn't see it before, because at last it makes sense of our experience, and we come to realize how we've been made to feel guilty about expressing the best that's in us. The second thing is that since heightened consciousness is not necessarily a blessing, we begin to see the injustices all around us in a very painful and sometimes unbearable way. There is nothing that we can do. Almost nothing that does not force those realizations upon us. We can no longer drive through a ghetto, whether it's a white ghetto like Grosse Pointe or a black ghetto inside Detroit, and not understand that it's that is not natural and the kinds of painful injustice that it represents. We can no longer pick up a telephone and make a call without getting a female operator and never a male, and wondering why that is, and of course knowing why that is, and knowing too that most of those disproportionate numbers of those women are minority women, and how they're paid and how they're treated. We can't walk into an office building anymore because we see, you know, hundreds of one kind of human being typing and 10 of another kind in the boardroom. It's not acceptable. We can't look around a campus and see that the heads of the departments are men, or see which departments women are consigned to, or see who's really running the place in terms of administration, and not realize how unjust it is and how little it represents the country. There are only 35 of the people in this country who are over 35, white and male. I mean, they constitute about 15% of the country, apparently, but they're effectively running it. So it's clear, just visually clear, that the injustice is very simply unbearable. Now, a problem is, however, that even though we see it, we are very schooled in many kinds of loserism. We are schooled in accepting the system as it is. You know, I mean, I don't care whether it's it has to do with Congress and the White House and the war in Indochina, or whether it has to do with the jockocracy here on campus. Women are beginning to demand as much of a budget as the jockocrats have. To just think about things in a different way. We're beginning to examine male logic and to understand that logic is in the eye of the logician. It's been used to beat us down. For instance, male logic is that if a woman spends a year giving birth to and nurturing a child, then she's more responsible for that child until she or he grows up. But women have made a very revolutionary discovery, which is that children have two parents. If a woman spends that year having and nurturing a child, why isn't the man that much more than half responsible for the child? That's female logic. We're beginning to examine all these very basic premises. We're beginning to examine the male political labels and groups we've come out of. And I want to stress that because I think I understand how divisive that can be for women, because it happens to all of us all the time. We are made to turn against the woman who wears white gloves and has a Republican husband because we wear sandals and have a white radical lover. But the truth is that both the Republican woman and the white radical woman are doing the mimeographing and the typing and getting the coffee and playing a supportive role, putting him through graduate school. Which is the surest way to kill any relationship, you know, to put him through graduate school, unless he's going to do exactly the same for you. Resentment boils up, and, sometimes I wonder if men's reduced life expectancy isn't due to the fact that women do the cooking, but anyway. It's very destructive, and we have to reevaluate all these labels. For some of us who sort of come out of various parts of the left, it's not easy. It's not easy to look at Marx, say, for the first time, with this in the light of revolutionary feminism, and say, wait a minute, you know, Marx really wasn't radical enough. He really didn't look at the divisions of labor as primarily racial and sexual, because of the society he came out of, and because he was a patriarch himself, he was very much more likely to look at class definitions. But he lived off his wife's silverware and jewelry, you know, which is okay. I mean, by any means necessary, right? But she was a pretty good writer, and she didn't get to do much. And his daughter committed suicide because for a lot of complex reasons. She was speaking for the socialist movement, but she had no part in it because she was a woman. We're looking at things in entirely new ways. We understand that that just from a statistical point of view, who resists this change the most, this great sea change that's going on among women now, is the liberal, white, upper-income, college-educated, socially upward mobile male. It is not necessarily the conservative male or the working-class male who can see a kind of logic to the idea of two incomes per family, supposing people choose to live as a family, and who anyway doesn't have that much to lose. But it's the people who have the most to lose in this country who are resisting this kind of change the most. I'd like to say one other thing, which is really directed more toward the women here, and is because I know very well that most of the women here know everything I'm saying. You see, we only come as outside agitators and outside support. If you really want to know something, turn to the woman next to you. She knows where the bodies are buried here and what the problems are here. I hope we'll talk about that during the question period. But we had a bad time in various women's groups because we were allowing ourselves to be divided along male lines. Furthermore, we responded to style in ways that were destructive. For instance, we're all damaged people. Women are, in general, and it's to the extent that we are a caste as a group, we are damaged people because we have not been allowed to or encouraged to express the very best that's in us or to control anything, not even our own lives. So when women come into the movement, which is the very first place that we've been allowed to, that we've had to express ourselves, we behave in two kinds of ways in general, or at least two extremes of ways. If we're older and we've been in more conservative male groups, then we go kind of power crazy, you know, when we get into the women's group. We want to control everything we want. It's our first thing that we've had to control. If we're younger and out of the more so-called radical male groups, then we react to the same damage in a different way, which is to say, okay, I've been obscure all my life, and I have never had anything of my own, and nobody else is damn well going to have anything of their own either. So no last names, no credit even for individual work. Everything has to be communal, and so on. And there are these two extremes of reaction. And we don't know what the answer is. We know we don't want to duplicate the male hierarchy. We know we don't want to go on a power trip. We also know that it keeps us honest and makes us creative to have some individual credit. And women of all people are hungry for something that belongs to them, for work that is their own. So we're all struggling somehow to find the human combination of developing ourselves and supporting our sisters. I feel, I know that you have to go back to class, and I feel that I don't want to go on too long, because one of my most important functions here is to be a prelude to Margaret. I mean, I set you up, she knocks you down, see? I can't go after her because she makes me look like I'm standing still. But I think that once we understand that this is a revolution and not a reform, that we are talking about about eradicating the most fundamental kind of division of labor, that we begin to see the seriousness of it, we begin to see the way in which it affects everything. We see more clearly the masculine mystique, the whole notion that you, in order to be a male, which is certainly a notion that dehumanizes men. I don't think men can be oppressed exactly, white men, because at least you don't look different. I mean, you can be exploited and dehumanized, but you can maybe rise up out of it because you're not marked on your skins. But still, men are very seriously dehumanized by the whole notion that to be a man, they have to be strong and to win all the time and to earn a lot of money. And, I mean, I don't know, the notion that manhood depends on the size of a paycheck is really, talk about obscenity. It seems to me a very obscene notion. That you have to be the sole support of a family, even though most men in this country, most white men in this country cannot. Most white women in this country work at least part of the time outside the home. And how much more cruel is it, therefore, to say to black men or any minority man that he is not a real man unless he is the sole support of a family in this kind of white European style. That you have to have short hair and what else? Shoot small animals. That's what they did in Toledo. They also beat each other up in bars on Friday and Saturday night. To be a member of the jockocracy in good standing, no matter how much you may dislike it or fear it. to have a kind of job pattern that means you're obsessively focused on a job and you don't really have time to see your own children, to see your own family if you want to see friends, to change your job in midstream if you want. We are seeing how that kind of masculine mystique affects foreign policy, how in fact it is probably the dominant reason why we are in Vietnam and certainly the one why we stay. I mean, the white men who rule this country have so attached their manhood, such as it might be, to the identity of this country. And of course, the more unsure they are of themselves, the more forceful they are, and the more they need to, assert the manhood of the country, that they cannot, even though they clearly cannot win in Indochina, they cannot admit that they have lost. And they have been allowed, white men, by and large, in this country, as a group anyway, and I'm not talking, of course, there are individual exceptions, and we honor them, and we welcome them, but as a group, white men have been allowed to develop enormous egos, which I always envision as traveling over their heads like some big balloon. It makes them very vulnerable, of course, and then if you brush up against the balloon in any way, this huge outsized ego they've got, then it's your fault because you're castrating him. One of the most sophisticated arguments against the movement is that men are fragile. We should preserve them in their ruling class position because they're fragile, which is not unlike saying that, well, white people can't possibly work in the fields like blacks. I mean, they just aren't up to it. So we're beginning to say to white men that, look, I mean, okay, yes, you've been trained all your lives to feel that no matter how bad things get, you can count on being superior to two groups, to all women and to non-white men. But that's your problem, not ours. And you're going to have to deal with it, not us. And the true courage is the courage that dares to be an individual, to be human, to give up white skin and male privileges, and to develop and compete equally with other human beings. That's courage, not going off to Indochina to fight in a racist and illegal and unspeakable war. It affects everything we do, this change. It affects our language. It affects the way we treat each other. It affects married couples who say both of whom are working and yet the woman is more responsible for the kids and getting dinner than the husband is. It affects students, because this is the time when women students should be dreaming, and men should be dreaming the biggest dreams and hoping the biggest hopes. But it is the time when you are at the height of getting educated politically to feel like half a person, you know, so that you will behave like half a person, vote like it, get married in a system that's meant for a person and a half, get paid half as much as a man, and so that you will feel you have no identity without a man. My favorite anecdote is a woman who told me, this was early in our going around to speak, so I didn't understand that things were still not so different from the 50s when I was a student. And she said, no, well, now here's a political situation, for instance. She and another friend, a woman friend, had been going to the movies together, and they liked and respected each other. They were going to see a movie they wanted to see. A man called one of them up. The man was 4'2" and had terminal acne and... And no redeeming features of any kind. See, we give them a chance for redeeming features, right? That's more than they give to us. But the woman went like a shot because she had been trained all her life to feel she had no identity without a man. There had to be in life or on Saturday night or, you know, on any occasion, there had to be a man standing there. She had become a man junkie, in fact. She needed... She needed a shot of identity, right? She needed a man to prove that she was a real person. If men only understood how little it matters which man is standing there, they might be... I mean, it's still going on. Huh? Yes, men need, or women need and love, some women need and love men, but not any more than men need and love women. If it isn't equal, it's not a relationship. And far from being the death of love, as has a charge often leveled against the women's movement, it may make love possible for the first time, because it is only possible between equals. So if we really live this change every day, and it is a very revolutionary and a very radical one, and I'm afraid that our grace period, if it can be called that, of not being taken seriously is coming to an end. I think that the men in power are beginning to realize just how deeply radical this is, and beginning to look at the Equal Rights Amendment, for instance, as a major weapon for the redistribution of the wealth in this country, which is possibly what was glimmering in the minds of the not-too-bright state legislators who turned it down recently. But, of course, we have to make it very clear that they just won't be there next year unless they vote. That if we live it every day, and have that kind of courage, and it is courage, then maybe we have a chance, because we've had, after all, 5,000 years of patriarchy, or 5,000 years of gynocracy, 5,000 years of patriarchy and racism, and we just might make it to 5,000 years of humanism, who knows? And historians just might look back at this time and say that for the first time, the human animal stopped dividing itself up according to visible difference, according to sex, according to race, and started to look for the real and the human potential that's inside all of us. Thank you.
Rushing off to a class to get miseducated wasn't going to happen. What? What? Who didn't give me the time? She should have stopped at 12:30. We usually, you know, I usually speak 40. Sometimes she speaks 20. We don't, I mean, it just depends on the situation. Some of you all that are standing in the back could sit now, because there's seats here. Be aggressive, come up front. You know, from speaking in the South, I get so nervous with all these open doors, I keep looking behind me, thinking something's going to come at me. You know, I'm up here, up South, I guess. Give you 30 seconds. There's still seats up. Cool. I feel sort of disoriented. I mean, I'm so close to Chicago, it makes me nervous. And being there 24 years is not the most exciting opportunity for growth. I'm not going to talk very long, because with a group this size, I'm really more concerned about your questions anyway, because you're probably going to ask some of the same things that I'd cover. I'd like to clear a few things. Oh, my name is Margaret, by the way. I like to clear a few things out that I just get asked from the start, and I just sort of like to eliminate those right away because I get bored by them a lot of times. That doesn't have anything to do with you personally. It's just that I do get bored by a lot of assumptions that are made when Gloria and I come to campuses and speak. First of all, they're not very, very comfortable about having a black and white woman speak because that's somehow some unnatural coalition. So that's a threat right there. And they either tend to, you know, the press will tend to either zero in on a Gloria and ignore me because I must be being duped or being paid or something. It must be clearly some other reason. But, you know, they always ask about priorities and how come you're speaking on the women's movement. And I used to get bothered by that, you know, 2.5 years ago. Again, now I get bored. I mean, as a black female, I have always fought my oppression where I felt it. And it would be a lot easier for me to separate out the weak. And again, don't get hung up on four-letter words. I know the press always deals with that. I'm more concerned about the pollution out there, not about my polluted mouth, so don't get worried about that. But they will always say, you know, well, what are your priorities and how come you're in the women's movement? And if the oppressor would separate the seven-day week out and say, well, Monday to Wednesday, we're going to fuck over you because you're a woman, and the rest of the week we're going to screw you because you're black, it would be easier for me. It just hasn't happened that way. You know, it would make it easy because then maybe on Wednesday, if I didn't want to, you know, I'd stay home. But it just doesn't happen that way. And a lot of people came down, Congresswoman Chisholm, who was running for president, and she said in her book that she personally felt more discrimination as a female than she had black, and people, you know, thought she was trading the nation and all kinds of things like that. But see, in some areas today, I might clearly get accepted and clearly get in, and the door might open, or two token doors might open for me because I'm black. But because I'm a woman, that's just not true. That hasn't been my experience. So for me, coming out of male left movements, white and or black or any combination of thereof, and starting very young at 14, the contradictions were so profound, but I didn't understand what was going on. I clearly thought it was me and my problem. I remember the first time I walked into, I was 14, I was just all excited and I wanted to get involved, and somebody said, well, there's a meeting in Court Took Over Building, and I just said, oh, I gotta go, and I was 14 and young and gifted and confused, and so I go over to 49th and St. Lawrence, the building, and I walk in, and I'm just so, you know, happy and everything because I made that stand. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't care, but I want to be involved. And I walk in, and I'm first thing that happened to me was somebody, some dude, threw some musty sweatshirt at me and said, hey, sister, sew this for me. And I couldn't sew. And then as I walked through the building, you know, I could see the various different kinds of situations, political situations that were going on. There's a white woman in the kitchen making lemonade, and there was two women, black and white, in the bed. And as I came back up to the front room, the living room that can be converted into a conference room, there was a circular combination of heads, black and white men, who were plotting the future. I found out in CORE that my position in CORE, as other women's, presented on the mobility of us at night and how flexible we could be. And, of course, the greatest coalition going was the oppressed coalition, the put-down coalition of black and white men. And if you were sleeping with both of them, you might got to almost go out and really speak for the group. It was a very bad thing, but I still didn't understand. I still believed all that. Then I went south, and I put in a lot of energy, got my head busted. I'm sure some people hoped I was dead. I did a lot of things. All of us did. We put a lot of energies into the movements. And again, when it came time for coming back to the offices, to the meetings, and making decisions, we were asked to make coffee and type and leaflet. I got to think that God made women, black women particularly, to leaflet. I just, every time somebody hands me something now, automatically, I just pass it out, just hand it out like this. And I knew that in myself and other women had a certain amount of creativity and talent, and those of us who refused to type at an early age, very unconsciously, we had no worth in those organizations. So coming out of that kind of frustration, looking around to, well, what is our position in the movement, quote-unquote, brothers, and then we got the answer from Stokely saying, prone, We could not accept this. We could not accept this at all, and we still today refuse to accept it. It was a very kind of eye-opening thing. It was only until a lot of us in SNCC, a lot of us from CORE, a lot of the women that used to be in those organizations and movements, when I go around the country, I see them like after like 5, 8 years, you know, a lot of us really started understanding and realizing the importance of ourselves as black women, you know. And even today, not so much has changed. We have a lot of token changes for black people. And I have to qualify that and say that most of those token changes have not been in the benefit for the larger half of the nation, which are black women. We still don't understand what our position is into the larger liberation struggle of black people. It's very confused. It's also very confusing for us when we talk to black men. And I say brothers in quote because anybody that's oppressing me is not my brother. And so therefore, I have to make that distinction. Anybody that's participating in my oppression is not my brother or sister. But you look around today and you get very confused because the demands, the goals of the women's movement are clearly women's issues, clearly things that black and brown and yellow and red women can identify with. There's just some things that cross those racial lines, no matter how you look at it. In fact, because black women are so messed up by the system and the dual stigma being black and female, it would seem that we should be in the forefront of most of the demands. Just the one demand for abortion, for example. 80% of the women that die every year from illegal abortions in this country are black and brown women, you know. So to take that and say that we're not concerned about this and to have somebody, some Mickey Mouse street corner revolutionary, talking about genocide, I find that a farce. I really do. They always talk about, well, we have to have the revolutionaries and the nation, and we have to carry the baby in the womb and destroy the white man. And I'm concerned about those revolutionaries. This is what they say to me. I'm more concerned about the revolutionaries that are walking around the street now, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old, that can't be fed, that are hungry, that have no place to go. I'm concerned about those revolutionaries. And I'm also probably more concerned about the lives of the women who have to make that kinds of decision. And most of those decisions, in fact, all of those decisions about my reproductive freedom, about yours, is left up to an old bunch of moldy white men who can't even get it up. It's just amazing that we haven't turned this country around just on that one single demand there. I mean, but it's the same kind of thing. I mean, those old white men are making decisions about young men, black, brown, yellow, and red, about going off and fighting a racist war, too, you know? And as soon as we get this coalition together, we can turn the country around. It's no accident that a black female in this country with a BA degree earns slightly less than a black man with an 8th grade education. And according to the U.S. Department of Labor, which is not your champion feminist source, the income that's made annually by the two extremes, black and white, male and female, you have black women on the bottom, and then you have white women, and then you have black men, and you know who is on top. And I think this is very important to realize, and to say that we're not concerned about equal pay for equal work, that's another misconception, too. That one single demand, by the way, of equal pay for equal work, we could integrate black people, in this society, really without changing too much. But to talk about equal pay for equal work for 53% of the population would start a revolutionary economic revolution in this country overnight, you see. I think that the whole thing about welfare being a woman's issue, and we clearly know that it's a woman's issue. It's no accident that I believe 85 and 90% of the people on welfare are women and dependent children. And it's not really a black thing because two-thirds of y'all are white that are on welfare. We have a larger percentage in terms of our population, but two-thirds of the people on welfare are white. And for anybody to get hung up, you know, about welfare, just remember this, that every woman in this room is only one step away from being on, one man away from being on welfare. I think it's very important to remember that. I like Johnny Tillman's little line about welfare being sort of a super sexist marriage. And He's even jealous because he comes in, looks under your bed, and checks to see who you're sleeping with. And then when you get divorced, he keeps the kids, you know. It's that kind of parallel. The coalition that I'm trying to realize and that I see, but I don't see it when I read in the male-dominated press, nor when I see the coverage on certain kinds of demonstrations that have gone on in this country, certain kinds of meetings that we've had. The coalition that's just beginning to form, and maybe it's just forming because women understand so many things about women's problems, but I see third world women and white women beginning to understand who the real enemy is. And to not, because of our historical polarization, it's very difficult. I mean, the movement, it was a very difficult thing because if he couldn't get it from me, he could certainly get it from my white counterpart. At that same time, we were fighting each other over him, and guess what he was doing? You know, he had us both, really. And that kind of division, that kind of schism, I mean, rape, for example, I mean, he does not care what color you are. And somehow that's something that seems to transcend seems to transcend racial lines. Abortion, again, equal pay for equal work. Daycare, which by and large, unfortunately, has been left up to women, you know. Or child care, I should say, because there's a lot of people that need that kind of service, you know, not, you know, from 9 to 5, but at night. Clearly we can form coalitions on the certain things that we agree with, but white women are going to have to understand that coalition doesn't mean fusion. It means that you're going to have to understand the need for black women and brown women and third world women to get together and talk, you know, among themselves about the racism and the sexism that they face every day. And on the other hand of that, the black women can't stay so far away that they don't know where the action is and get misdirected and go to the wrong actions. The Gary Convention, for all its historical first, I felt very disappointed. I mean, with all those people and all those different factions under one roof, at one time a very historical precedent, nothing came out there in terms that would affect black women. Nothing. No demands for equal pay for equal work, nothing about abortion, nothing about welfare, nothing about daycare. And it really saddened me. And it's like that, unfortunately, black men are repeating the white male mistake, and I refuse to be a part of it. You know, people will say to me, well, you have to wait until, though this is something I get often, always from black men, don't you think we have to wait till after the revolution, and then we'll take care of you? Again, just negating of our importance as black women, somehow like, well, we'll get free first, and then we will take this long 9-foot hand and pull you to your freedom. It seems very cruel to just see that at a time when the man is fucking over both of us, black and male and female, to try to get black women into the kitchen and to talk about and to mouth Moynihan, who says that the problem with black men is black women, when we know the problem with black men is white racism. And no amount of getting me back in the kitchen is going to give any black man a job. It seems very dangerous. I could never understand among my black male friends who had clearly in all outward appearances had rejected white men. I mean, afros were this big, dashikis were that long, and they had little books under their arms quoting all kinds of things. I could never understand why they choose to imitate the white man and how he related to his woman. I never could understand that, and I still don't today. And it's about time, it seems to me, that black people have a chance not to repeat the white mistake. And for us to fall into that is a very dangerous game. I see black middle class, or rather I should say black middle income women, because there's a lot of people with income ain't got no class. But I see a lot of black middle income women who are falling into that same thing. I had a black woman come and tell me in Atlanta who's married to somebody that's making a little bit more money than most. And she said, you know, I was into that whole game, and I was married, and it wasn't absolutely necessary for our survival that I work. And so I found myself sitting home with other black middle-income women, and we were drinking tea and going to this and that. And she said, and somehow we were so unhappy and so frustrated, and we didn't know why, and we surely thought it was us. And she said, you know, we're imitating our white female counterpart, who obviously doesn't want to be a part of that. Look around you. And it's not necessary for us to go into that same kind of situation, repeat those same mistakes. I personally do not want a warmed over throne, you know. And about this business about after the revolution. You know, somehow I feel that if I really accepted that, it would mean for me that after the revolution, my job would be cooking grits for the revolutionaries. That doesn't turn me on somehow, you know. All my creativity, all my talents, all my other black sisters' talents should be used. And in some situations, if we realize that black women can do a better job because of her talents and creativities and experience, then we should be pushing her up front and encouraging her, too, because she is so damaged. She is so damaged. I mean, I have read all my life about, you know, well, not all my life. I read two things about black people in history when I was coming up in grammar school. I learned about the peanut. What's his name? Carver. George Washington Carver. And I learned about Crispus Attucks, this foolish nigga that died in the Revolutionary War to free white people from Britain. inconceivable. But that's who I read about. I never read about black women, you know. I found out my kid 2 years ago was going to Sojourner Truth daycare. I had to quickly look this up, you know, who was Sojourner Truth? Where are black female heroines for our young black women, you know? And it just seems to me that we are in a very uncomfortable, unfortunately, situation where we are so schizophrenic, we can't read about ourselves in history books, we hear that we're castrating, we hear we dare not be assertive because, like Frederick Douglass said back there so many years back, it is the day of the slave, and here black women are the slave of the slave. It just doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. It's very hurting because you wonder sometimes if you have any kind of worth at all. You know, and you go there and you give your life and you picket and you march and you're the backbone of every single black organization that's around, and yet you still aren't really making any headways in terms of yourself as women. The coalition that I was talking about, I have to say that I'm not talking about 53% of the population getting out there in the yard and hugging each other and saying everything is cool, because we have to understand racism and we have to understand imitation. I don't want to form a coalition with a white woman who is still reaping the benefits from those token privileges that you get from having the key to the master bedroom. I don't want that kind of coalition. I don't want a coalition with black women who refuse to give up that imitation of white, you know. But I'm talking about women who are clearly working out their racism, if they are white women, and clearly women who have feminist consciousness. Because, again, like Gloria said, we don't want to repeat the male mistake, which has messed all of us up, I think. Because of time, I'm more concerned about questions, so I don't want to go into too much more, because you'll probably ask them anyway. But next year, I refuse to quote another man. But because somehow when you quote some man, they listen to you just a little bit more. It's like when you have a white person, you live in a white neighborhood, somehow that makes your house better. Bobby Seale said in Seize the Time, oh, I'm sorry, I have to give another quote, because Celestine Ware is a black feminist from New York who's written a book called Woman Power. And I don't know whether you even be able to find it because it's like, you know, underground, right? And she has a chapter on black women and women's liberation. And the reason I want to mention this is because I am on a campus, and lots of times I meet with the black students afterwards, which I feel really good about. And unfortunately, it's usually a black man who will lead me to the room, and the black women will have been ridden me, telling me, please come, please come. And then when I come there, they sort of sit back, and then later on they speak up. And they will say to me, well, the black men will always say, well, you have to understand that if there's any problems between me and the black sisters, it's because of racism. And, you know, it's only so much you can blame. You can understand where that's coming from. But an example on Kalamazoo College, they had a black student organization that they set up. And in the Constitution, it was written that no black woman would ever hold office higher than a secretary. See? And then when the $2,000 that was appropriated to them suddenly disappeared, the black women said, well, where's the money? And they said, oh, it's a man's thing. We'll handle it. And that kind of thing, it's, again, that whole leftist male mistake that we shouldn't get into. But Celestine quotes something which I thought was very interesting. I just want to share it with you. If you're bored, go to sleep. She says, a reliable source in the Harvard Organization of Black Unity, which is OBU, asserts that whenever a black girl becomes too articulate and aggressive at the meetings, a boy from the group is assigned to seduce her. And then is this conquest keeper in a more traditional position within the organization. You see? And these are some things that we really have to deal with as black people. Otherwise, we're going to have a whole lot of emotional and psychic cripples, and we never have a revolution. Bobby Seale said in Seize the Time that in a Panther household, everyone makes the bed and everybody sweeps the floors and everybody makes the revolution, because real manhood depends on the subjugation of no one. Thank you.